And so they started once again at the very beginning and went over the ground minutely, searching for anything they might have overlooked at the first telling of it, this time exhaustively re-examining each fact from every angle, both of them applying their trained minds to the full, without being able to come up with more than they already had. One thing we must never let out of sight for a moment is the quality of the opposition, Peter summed up, as the sun began lowering itself towards the western horizon, its majestic progress flanked by cohorts of cumulonimbus cloud, rising into towering anvil heads over the scattered islands, like silent nuclear explosions. There are layers upon layers, reasons behind reasons. The kidnapping of Melissa Jane was not merely to force me to assassinate Kingston Parker, but you as well. The proverbial two birds, with a third bird to follow. If I had succeeded, I would have been hooked into Calif forever. Where do you and I go from here, Peter? She asked, tacitly transferring ultimate decision-making to him. How about home right now, he suggested, unless you fancy another night out here. Peter found that his possessions had been discreetly moved from the guest bungalow to the owner's magnificent private quarters on the north tip of the island. His toilet articles had been laid out in the mirrored master bathroom, which flanked that of the mistress. His clothing, all freshly cleaned and pressed, was in the master's dressing room, where there was 155 feet of louvered hanging space. Peter paced it out and calculated it would take 300 suits of clothing. There were specially designed swinging shelves for another 300 shirts, and racks for 100 pairs of shoes, although all were empty. His light cotton suit looked as lonely as a single camel in the midst of the Sahara Desert. His shoes had been burnished to a gloss that even his Batman had never been able to achieve. Despite himself, he searched the dressing room swiftly for the signs of previous occupancy, and was ridiculously relieved to find none. "I could learn to rough it like this," he told his reflection in the mirror, as he combed the damp, darkly curling locks off his forehead. The sitting room off the suite was on 3 levels, and had been decorated with cane furniture and luxuriant tropical plants, growing in ancient Greek wine amphoras, or in rockeries that were incorporated into the flowing design of the room. The creepers and huge, glossy leaves of the plants, toned in artistically with jungle-patterned curtaining, and the dense growth of exotic plants beyond the tall picture windows. Yet the room was cool and inviting, although the sound of air conditioning was covered by the tinkle of a waterfall down the cunningly contrived rock face that comprised one curved wall of the room. Tropical fish floated gracefully in the clear pools into which the waterfall spilled, and the perfume of growing flowers pervaded the room, and their blooms glowed in the subdued lighting. One of the little golden Polynesian girls brought a tray of 4 tall frosted glasses for Peter to choose from. They were all filled with fruit, and he could smell the sweet, warm odour of rum mingled with the fruit. He guessed they would be almost lethal, and asked for a whiskey, then relented as the girl's eyes flooded with disappointment. "I make them myself," she wailed. In that case, he sipped while she waited anxiously. "Parfait," he exclaimed, and she giggled with gratification, and went off wriggling her bottom under the brief pareo like a happy puppy. Magda came then, in a chiffon dress so gossamer-like that it floated about her like a fine green sea mist, through which her limbs gleamed as the light caught them. He felt the catch in his breathing as she came towards him, and he wondered if he would ever accustom himself to the impact of her beauty. She took the glass from his hand and tasted it. "Good," she said, and handed it back. But when the girl brought the tray, she refused with a smile. They moved about the room, Magda on his arm as she pointed out the rarer plants and fishes. "I built this wing after Aaron's death," she told him, and he realized that she wanted him to know that it contained no memories of another man. It amused him that she should find this important, and then he remembered his own furtive search of the dressing room for signs of a lover before him, and the amusement turned inward. One wall of the private dining room was a single sheet of armored glass, beyond which the living jewels of coral fish drifted in subtly lit sea caverns, and the fronds of magnificent sea plants waved in gentle unseen currents. Magda ordered the seating changed so they could be side by side in the low lover's seat facing the aquarium. "I do not like you to be far away any more," she explained, and she picked special titbits from the serving dishes for his plate. "This is a speciality of Les Neuf Poissons. You will eat it nowhere else in the world." She selected small deep-sea crustaceans from a steaming Creole sauce of spices and coconut cream, and at the end of the meal, she peeled chilled grapes from Australia with those delicate fingers, using the long, shell-pink nails with the precision of a skilled surgeon to remove the pips, and then placing them between his lips with thumb and forefinger. "You spoil me," he smiled. "I never had a doll when I was a little girl," she explained, smiling. A circular stone staircase led to the beach 50 feet below the dining room, and they left their shoes on the bottom step and walked barefooted on the smooth, damp sand, compacted as hard as cement by the receding tide. The moon was a few days past full, and its reflection drew a pathway of yellow light to the horizon. "Caliph must be made to believe that he has succeeded," Peter said abruptly, and she shivered against him. "I wish we could forget Caliph for one night. We cannot afford to forget him for a moment." "No, you are right. How do we make him believe that?" "You have to die," he felt her stiffen, "or at least appear to do so. It has to look as though I killed you." "Tell me," she invited quietly. "You told me that you have special arrangements for when you want to disappear."
"Yes, I do."
"How would you disappear from here if you had to do so?" She thought for only a moment. "Pierre would fly me to Bora Bora. I have friends there, good friends. I would take the island airline to Tahiti Far on another passport, and then a scheduled airline in the same name to California or New Zealand." "You have other papers?" he demanded. "Yes, of course." She sounded so surprised by the question that he expected her to ask, "Doesn't everybody?" "Fine," he said, "and we'll arrange a suspicious accident here. A scuba diving accident. Shark attack in deep water. No corpse."
"What is the point of all this, Peter?"
"If you are dead, Caliph is not going to make another attempt to have you killed."
"Good," she agreed.
"So you stay officially dead until we flush Caliph out," Peter told her, and it sounded like an order, but she did not demur as he went on. "And if I carry out Caliph's evident wishes by killing you, it's going to make me a very valuable asset. I will have proved myself, and so he will cherish me. It will give me another chance to get close to him. At least, it will give me a chance to check out a few wild hunches."
"Don't let's make my death too convincing, my love. I'm a great favourite of the police on Tahiti," she murmured. "I'd hate to have you end up under the guillotine at Tuaruru."
Peter woke before her and raised himself on one elbow over her to study her face, delighting to find new planes and angles to her high, broad cheekbones, gloating in the velvety texture of her skin, so fine that the pores were indefinable from farther than a few inches. Then he transferred his attention to the curve of her eyelashes that interlocked into a thick, dark palisade, seeming to seal her eyelids perpetually in sleep. Yet they sprang open suddenly, the huge black pools of her pupils shrinking rapidly as she focused. And for the first time, he realized that the irises were not pure green, but were flecked and shot through with gold and violet. The surprise of finding him over her changed slowly to pleasure, and she stretched her arms out over her head and arched her back, the way a lazy panther does when it rouses itself. The satin sheet slid down to her waist, and she prolonged the stretch a little longer than was necessary, a deliberate display of her body. "Every other morning of my life that I woke without you there was wasted," she murmured huskily, and raised her arms, still at full stretch to him, folding them gracefully around his neck, still holding her back arched so that the prominent dark red nipples brushed lightly against the crisp dark mat of curls that covered his own chest. "Let's pretend this will last forever," she whispered, with her lips an inch from his, and her breath was rich as an overblown rose, heavy with the smell of vital woman and rising passion. Then her lips spread softly, warmly against his, and she sucked his tongue deeply into her mouth with a low moan of wanting. And the hard, slim body began to work against his, the hands breaking from his neck and hunting down his spine, long curved nails pricking and goading him just short of pain. His own arousal was so swift and so brutally hard that she moaned again, and the tension went out of her body. It seemed to soften and spread like a wax figure held too close to the flame, her eyelids trembling closed, and her thighs falling apart. "So strong," she whispered deep in her throat, and he reared up over her, feeling supreme, invincible. "Peter, Peter," she cried, "oh yes, like that. Please, like that." Both of them, striving triumphantly for the moment of glory, when each was able to lose self and become for a fleeting instant part of the Godhead. Long afterwards, they lay side by side in the enormous bed, both of them stretched out flat upon their backs, not touching except for the fingers of one hand intertwined as their bodies had been. "I will go away," she whispered, "because I have to. But not now, not yet." He did not reply. The effort was beyond him, and her own voice was languorous with a surfeit of pleasure. "I will make a bargain with you. Give me 3 days more, only 3 days, to be happy like this. For me it is the first time. I have never known this before, and it may be the last time." He tried to rouse himself to deny it, but she squeezed his fingers for silence and went on. "It may be the last," she repeated, "and I want to have it all. 3 days in which we do not mention Caliph, in which we do not think of the blood and striving and suffering out there. If you give me that, I will do everything that you want me to do. Is it a bargain, Peter? Tell me we can have that." "Yes, we can have that." "Then tell me you love me again. I do not think I can hear you say it too often." He said it often during those magic days, and she had spoken the truth. Each time he told her, she accepted with as much joy as the last time, and always each seemed to be within touching distance of the other. Even when tearing side by side across the warm, flat waters of the lagoon, leaning back with straight arms on the tow lines, skis hissing angrily and carving fiercely sparkling wings of water from the surface as they wove back and forth in a pas de deux across the streaming, creaming water, laughing together in the wind and the engine roar of the Chriscraft, Hapiti, the Polynesian boatman on the flying bridge, looking back with a great white grin of sympathy for their joy. Finning gently through mysterious blue and dappled depths, the only sound the wheezing suck and blow of their scuba valves, and the soft clicking and the eternal echoing susurration that is the pulse beat of the ocean, holding hands as they sank down to the long-abandoned hull of the Japanese aircraft carrier, now overgrown with a waving forest of sea growth and populated by a teeming, fascinating multitude of beautiful and bizarre creatures. Flying silently down the sheer steel cliff of the canted flying deck, which seemed to reach down into the very oceanic depths, so that there was the eerie fear of suddenly being deprived of support and falling down to where the surface light blued out into nothingness. Pausing to peer through their glass faceplates into the still gaping wounds rent into the steel by aerial bombs and high explosive, and then entering through those cruel caverns, cautiously as children into a haunted house, and emerging victoriously with carrier nets of trophies, coins and cutlery, brass and porcelain,